You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. I get to say that. Well, today I get to say that. I think I'm going to have to stop saying that tomorrow.
Today is Wednesday, February 28th, 2024, and it is 50 degrees right now as Lois and I are preparing this broadcast for Thursday. And by the time it airs on Thursday, it's probably not going to be a bright, sunny day in the Sacramento Valley. The low this morning, just so you all know, was 37 degrees. Much colder air has moved in, and we're going into a lively weekend in Northern California. For us, here in the Sacramento Valley, it's just going to be cold, windy, and there will be storms, but mostly what they're calling showers, because it's not going to be continuous, I would say, relentless rain, such as we were having back when we were getting those more tropical atmospheric rivers coming. This is a cold storm. So Friday, the high is going to be 56 degrees. Friday night, the low is going to be 43 degrees. Saturday, the high is going to be 52 degrees. There will be showers, including some fairly heavy at times, both Friday and Saturday, even Thursday night. And then Saturday night, the low is going to be 38 degrees. Clearing out somewhat Sunday, and it may be rather pretty, but the low on Sunday morning is going to be 37, and there's going to be a chance of frost as we get into Sunday night and even Monday morning. So very cold air pulling in behind this storm.
Now, and it's not tomato planting weather.
Yeah, no, I think we can make that pretty clear. It's also not a weekend to go up to the mountains, period. There is actually a blizzard warning in place.
Blizzard?
Blizzard warning in place. And so this little bit here is more for perhaps the amusement of folks who live in colder climates to hear what we're being told here in the Sacramento Valley and in Northern California. This is Rob Karlmark, who is a weather reporter for ABC 10. This is from his Facebook page. He's got a great Facebook page, lots of cool graphics there. Thursday, later afternoon, 3 to 5 p.m., the rain and snow move in. First day is not that crazy early, but it's getting colder and it's more consistent. By evening, it's ripping with rain, wind, and snow. Friday and Saturday are high impact days. For the valley, it's about 1 to 3 inches of rain, but spread out, so I'm not too worried about flooding, just the interference of outdoor things, you know, like gardening, and daily life with some solid rain. As always, driving is your biggest risk in rain, so please slow down and watch for ponding. Now for the snow. This is a big deal. We're looking at 4 to 8 feet of snow. We even have model estimates over 10 feet of snow. That seems very high. The bottom line, this will bury the Sierra above 5,000 feet with snow. In addition to the snow between Thursday and Sunday morning, we have very strong winds, so that will cancel visibility. We will have whiteout, even blizzard conditions at times. Let me tell you something, he says, about a blizzard, because we don't often get that here. It's not only dangerous to drive in. Plows can't keep up. The drifts will get your car stuck, even with 4x4s and chains. It's also not really safe to walk around in it. It sounds not real, but your normal way of referencing things like streets, street signs, cars, homes can sometimes just not be visible or covered in big drifts. Then you have a hard time knowing where you are. He says, I briefly went out in the blizzard in Montana to the end of the driveway once. I was like, nope, going in now. So let me tell you what the locals will be doing in the storm up high in the Sierra. Nothing. They will be stocked up and assume they will lose power. They'll venture out only around their home and apartment to clear snow from paths and vehicles and try to make it easier for dig out day, which is likely Sunday. Have you ever heard of dig out day? You have. I haven't.
I didn't think I'd ever hear of it out here
in California. Getting in a car to go do something in a storm like this is not fun, can get bad quickly. Local folks just hunker down, keep it very local, neighbors at most. So if you think it's going to be business as usual, it isn't. Those big snowstorms have a way of reminding us that sometimes nature wins and you can't just will your desires into existence. Be a lot of sitting inside, looking out the window and saying, looks bad, and then going back to sitting down in the Sierra during the storm. Sunday it clears out for rain and snow and might actually be a nice day in the valley, just wet from the previous rain. Okay, so He goes on and go ahead.
You keep going. Keep going.
For water, for water supplies, just so you all know, we're in really good shape. Rain in the bucket is above average for all. Reservoirs are above average. And even for snow, this will get us to average, if not above. And that's a great place to be for the beginning of March. As he says, enjoy today, Wednesday, and tomorrow. Plan for the storm and be safe. And by the way, your plans are irrelevant in this storm. This may seem a bit harsh, but I just want to get ahead of something I see popping up all over the place. Quote, I have a reservation in Tahoe for Friday and Saturday, wondering which is the best route to avoid the storm.
It isn't. The whole thing is under a storm watch.
I'm going to beat the storm and come up on Thursday. Does anybody know some last minute places to stay for cheap?
Oh, my goodness.
I have to get from Reno to Sacramento on Saturday. What's the best time to leave, morning or night? The issue is that if this storm,
Wednesday.
If this storm were classified as a hurricane, people would abandon their ideas of doing things in it, respectfully not try to keep them going in spite of the weather. Just like a hurricane, a blizzard is a kind of storm that just shuts everything down. In other words, there is no Tahoe when and if you get there. It will just be empty roads and places shut down, with the only people out just trying to keep up with the snow by shoveling and plowing. It is not appropriate, and in some cases it is dangerous to go out and do anything in a storm like this in the Sierra. It's big, powerful, will last for several days, and it deserves your respect. A blizzard of this size is really a big deal. We're not too familiar with this around here, even though blizzard conditions do happen at times during storms fairly often. This is different. It's for a much bigger area. It will last for days, not hours. The hallmark of a blizzard is people getting lost or disoriented, venturing out of their vehicle. Bad things happen. People get stuck driving in them. So his suggestion is stay home, okay? And enjoy the weather down here in the valley, even though it's going to be rather cold and, let's say, rainy, but nothing like we have been experiencing in the last few weeks. That's your public service announcement from KDRT.
One other thing to think. Now, I have lived in backwoods Michigan, and it is not uncommon for us to have large snowstorms. So when you're planning yourself, what you're going to do up there in the hills, consider what would happen if the electricity went out.
Yeah,
because it might well go out. And so
almost surely will. Yeah.
Have you got battery lanterns, or have you got a fireplace? What have you got to eat that you don't have to heat up? Or do you have a cooking stove like you went camping? Maybe pull out your camping gear just in case.
Check it out now. There you go. Check it out today.
It's probably going to be gone for you. So no getting on and doing your emails.
Yeah, so they're trying to let you know that this is a real big deal, because Californians tend to be a little blasé about weather until it actually hits. This is a very cold storm. So the key for us is that when it's cold, there's less rain and more snow. The snow level is actually going to drop down quite low for this, especially for the time of year. So the main thing we will be dealing with here as gardeners and trying to get around and stuff, it's not going to be a lot of flooding, not going to be all that dangerous here in the Sacramento Valley, but temperatures about 20 degrees below what we've been experiencing for the last few days. For those of you in other parts of the country, it's been sunny and gorgeous in California, finally, for a few days, and people are getting into the gardening mood. We'll come back to the timeliness of certain garden activities in just a moment. I do want to mention KDRT is community radio. That means public radio. We rely on contributions from folks like you to fund our operating costs. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. Well, you're over there. There is lots of great programming, and there's been some changes. There will be some schedule changes coming up, but I want to talk about one change that's a change in the change backwards, change to the past. Peter Pasteur, who for a long time did a show called Listening Lyrics, 10 years, and then went on to do a news show, not a news show. We call them a
talk show.
Talk show. Thank you.
Public service show.
Public service. Is that what, that's not what we call them, though. Anyway.
That's what I call mine, a talk show.
Talk show. There you go. Well, he's back. So it's back to Listening Lyrics, which is music and talk. He brings the artists in and talks to them about their music. And then frequently they play music right there in the studio. It's not unusual for musicians' guitars to get lost or stolen, says Peter about a recent show. When the theft or loss involves a famous musician, it becomes a story. And that's what the February 23rd Listening Lyrics program is about. 6 lost but found guitars owned by Zach Wilde, Peter Frampton, Jimmy Page, this is like a trip down memory lane here, Joe Perry, Bill Corgan, and Paul McCartney. Each guitar had a fantastic journey. Want to listen to it? Head on over to kdrt.org. It's right on the homepage right now. Listening lyrics, February 23, 2024.
We have so much to talk about today, Don.
And well, weather is a good starting point. Hey,
weren't we gonna talk about something outside the station for our public service announcement?
Oh, you mean the mosquitoes? The mosquitoes that are eating everybody up right now? Yes, there's been a massive outbreak of mosquitoes here in the Sacramento Valley, and I'm getting a lot of questions and comments about them, ranging from, oh, it's a sign of climate change, to this, that, or the other. This actually does happen every year. We always get this little outbreak. I believe you have the PSA that was sent out in January by the Sacramento YOLO Mosquito Control District. Did I get that right?
Fightthebite.net is the website for y'all to remember. And when you go there, you can find lots of articles about lots of things. Let me read this one to you. And this is January 30th is the date on this. Feels like spring is in the air with the warming temperatures and mosquitoes are out and looking to bite. Says Gary Goodman, this is typical trend that we see every year when we get a few days of sunny and warm weather. He's the manager of the Sacramento YOLO Mosquito and Vector Control District. These mosquitoes are ones that have been hibernating during the past few months. The warm temperatures have brought them out of resting and they are aggressively biting. Fortunately, these mosquitoes are not the same species that pose a threat of West Nile virus and are considered seasonal nuisance common during this time of year. District crews have been looking for and inspecting areas where these mosquitoes can breed. Over the past few days, the number of service requests received by the district has been on the rise. Since people are spending more time outside in the warmer weather, they are noticing the mosquitoes. While the official start of spring is not until March, temperatures have been warm during bringing the mosquitoes out. Luckily, rain is in the forecast for the next few days, and so we should get a break.
Well, that was actually a few weeks ago, but cold.
But that's true now.
Cold temperatures are in the forecast, which should slow things down a little bit as well.
Yeah. And the best protection against mosquito bites is wearing long sleeves and pants when spending time outdoors, as well as using an effective mosquito repellent, which contains DEET, Picaridin, or oil of lemon eucalyptus.
That's very interesting that they recommend one particular herbal repellent. First of all, let's mention fightthebite.net. You should probably walk around your property and look for standing water. We walked around our nursery just trying to see if there were any buckets or water-holding things that were breeding mosquitoes. We didn't find any on our site, but it can be as simple as old tires. I mean, things that you're not expecting that would be breeding mosquitoes, a dog bowl that you've forgotten about that's been filling up with rainwater, that kind of thing. It's about, a 10-day population turnaround on them when it's colder like this, much faster as we get into warmer weather. But try and find the sources on your own property if you can. There are organic approaches to managing mosquitoes, mosquito dunks, mosquito bits. These are Bacillus thuringiensis products that are specific for mosquitoes. You just throw them into the water source if you can't drain it out for some reason. Check your check your garden ponds. They may not have mosquito fish in them anymore. Hard to say. So look for those, and you can go and buy BT-based products. Not the same ones you use for caterpillar, but the same idea, the same genus and species, different strain of BT that is specific for mosquitoes. And you throw it in there, and I can tell you they work very, very well. In the long run, if you have standing water intentionally, like a pond, fightthebite.net is a resource for mosquito fish. You can submit a request through that email, through that site, using the email link, and they'll come by and bring them by, probably a little later in the season, but they will bring out mosquito fish. My own experience with mosquito fish, they're amazingly hardy little animals. I mean, they can live in a remarkably shallow amount of water, and they can go down to very cold temperatures. So once you have an established population, I have 4 different livestock troughs around my property, made a point of walking around to each of them to make sure there were still mosquito fish active in them. And indeed, they all made it through the winter on my place. If they happen to bring you the other kind of fish that they use, which are guppies, those are not winter hardy. They sometimes do those for a reason they can explain to you, in which case they would need to be replaced, but they will do it for you. If you're in YOLO, Sacramento County's fightthebite.net. Also, great information on their website.
Okay. And this, one of the things to think about is, I like birds, you know that. And I have a bird bath just outside the kitchen window. And it's wonderful. But you know, I need to go out there every week and hose out that bird bath, get rid of the water and replace it because I don't want it growing mosquitoes.
Seems very shallow, but it would certainly be possible. They'd also be quite visible in that situation. The ponds concern me a little more because there's often a layer of something on top, you know, whether it's algae or plants that you've put in there. You may not be seeing the mosquito wrigglers, but once you see them and know what they look like, just learn to walk around and spot for them. I am, of course, getting people coming in who've gone online and want to buy plants that will repel mosquitoes. It's so frustrating because they're really nice people and they want to be gardeners. And they want to be doing something organic and safe and natural. The plant itself will not repel mosquitoes.
Simply, what plant are we talking about?
Oh, it varies. If you look at, there's lists online that include a whole lot of things. The most common they're asking for is citronella, which is a type of pelargonium, which means it's like a garden geranium. Okay. So it's related to the garden geraniums your grandmother grew, but, and it has a flower that's very similar if it ever does flower for you. But like the other scented geraniums, citronella contains special volatile organic compounds and things in the leaves that in the case of that one smell just like lemon pledge. I mean, it's that very strong. Citrosa is one of the names it's being sold under.
So citronella, I know as something that you would put on your skin, I mean, the liquid you would put on your skin because mosquitoes wouldn't like to bite your skin if it was covered in citronella. But right. The plant, I mean, wouldn't you have to roll in the plant to get it all over your skin and do that every, I don't know, half hour or so?
Well, that's exactly right. And this is what frustrates me about these websites that list these plants. They make it sound as though if you plant, one of the things they often list is lavender or things like the citronella. If you plant them near your front door, you're not going to have mosquitoes. No, that doesn't work. Yes, they emit volatile organic compounds somewhat. Yes, the volatile organic compounds in some cases are things that would repel mosquitoes locally. To repel them from biting you, it needs to be on your skin. In fact, if you look at the herbal repellents, they typically contain things that smell a lot like lemon pledge. Citronella is a compound that's in many totally unrelated plants. There's some in a particular type of eucalyptus. There's some in this particular pelargonium or geranium. It's in lemongrass. If you happen to be fond of Thai cooking, it's the same active ingredient in that. It works if you squish up the leaves, rub them all over your skin, about every 30 minutes or so. After a while, you're going to get tired of that smell. I pretty much guarantee it.
And wouldn't it be easier just to get some official mosquito repellent, something that has DEET in it or something, and then just cover up your arms and your legs and just put it on your hands and your face?
Yes, but there are many people that, for whatever reason, don't want to use DEET. So you'll find the ones, as the mosquito abatement district mentioned, one that contains oil of lemon eucalyptus, something like that. So that's working on the same principle. Not as effective, not for as long, but it is a natural approach. The thing is, planting the plant in your garden, having the plant in your house, I mean, I've seen them selling these at, let's say, Trader Joe's, places like that, grocery stores. Sure, you can try and grow it in a window. I mean, you can grow different pelargoniums in your window reasonably well, and you can crush a leaf and enjoy the smell of it. There's nothing particularly wrong with that. It's not false advertising or anything. But it isn't really going to repel the mosquitoes. So anyway, enough about that. That's just one of these popular myths that is out there. You'll often see 6 or 7 different types of plants listed. I've kind of gone through the list and realized that pretty much what all of them have is aromatic foliage. And the idea is that aromatic foliage will somehow persuade a mosquito to go to your neighbor's house or something. No, they don't work in that regard. They're all great plants, by the way, and most of them are full sun loving plants and surprisingly easy to grow. So if this does entice you into gardening, cool. But if you think it's going to repel the mosquitoes, I hate to disappoint you.
Don, it's cold and dark and rainy in the winter. Are any of those things growing in the winter?
In our climate, if you have a window that faces south.
Oh, you're talking about indoor plants. I was thinking about outdoor plants.
But outdoors, that particular plant that is being requested, Citrosa or Citronella, like pelargoniums, is frost tender. That doesn't mean it's killed by frost, but it will probably defoliate pretty badly. Now, we're past significant killing frost most likely at this point. I feel
37 degrees today?
Yeah, 37, not 27. So I feel fairly safe saying that the plant would be injured but would recover. Outside right now in a sunny location near the house, it would undoubtedly be fine. Here's the problem we're running into, and we're retailers, and all the retailers in California are experiencing this. When we have sunny weather, boy, people come out. They're getting cabin fever. And they come in, they say, hey, when are your lantana going to be here? Hey, I'm looking for verbena. And they're rattling off all these heat-loving, summer-loving plants. I had people asking me if they could start planting zinnias now.
Answer is no, you can't plant them. You could buy them.
You can buy the seed. We'll be starting zinnia seed, just as one example, in the first week of April for people to plant out in May. Most of the things they're talking about have been subtropical plants, and they're not happy when the nights are below 50, much less below 40. So if anyone has them a couple of my growers have these, and I've looked at their lists and thought, if I brought that in, as many places probably would do, it would go from greenhouse 85 degree temperatures to outside in my nursery. There will be some effects from that. It's not going to kill the plant, but there will be discoloration of the foliage. The blossoms will stop developing. There'll be harm to the open petals. In other words, they'll be less retail worthy once they've been out there for a couple of days. Really best for those things that really need heat. Yeah, you really want some color. Wait until April or May and into, of course, the early summer. Right now, of course, you can buy pansies, violas, snapdragon, cyclamen, if anybody still has them, they're tending to run out at this point. Those are all things that love cool weather and that will continue to bloom through March and usually through April, sometimes even into May, depends on when we start getting high temperature problems for those plants. So we are seasonal here. I know it doesn't seem like it to people in real extreme climates. We are seasonal and we're still doing the cool season stuff. Pansies look great right now. Dwarf snapdragons look great right now. The other key question, and this is a challenging one for retailers, vegetables. We're at that in-between time. Yeah, I have kale, I have lettuce, I have bok choy, I have things like that. I have the leafy greens that people can plant real crowded in pots and just sort of start harvesting right away. That's all fine. You'll easily get the month of March out of those, even into April. Last year, they went right through April into May because it was relatively cool. You're sort of in a race against time. Can you still plant garden peas? Sure, if you pre-germinate them first week of March, you're hopefully gonna be harvesting in the first week of May. All right. Now, if you've lived here long enough, first week of May could be perfectly pleasant or could be too hot for them. So you're taking a bit of a gamble. So that's the it's almost too late problem crowd.
And then there's the it's certainly too early.
Yes, it's certainly too early crowd. So I want to make a distinction here because this came up at our garden center. Someone came in and asked, when will you get your tomatoes in? And my employee started answering, for best results, we plant tomatoes in April, peppers and eggplants in May. We say it's almost a trigger for us. We just say it just like that. And I thought, wait a minute, he didn't ask, when do you plant them? He asked, yes, when will you get them? And there is a subcategory of gardeners in the summer vegetables who want to buy them early to do the things that we talk about on the show. Take them from the little 3-inch pots, shift them into gallon cans, put them in their greenhouse, a little pop-up greenhouse. This is when a pop-up greenhouse is miraculous, by the way, because it's really warm in there. Our greenhouses are getting into mid 80s on a sunny day. Still getting cold at night, but every day is warm. Or they have that corner like I do right near the front door where it traps heat first thing in the morning, so they'll do very well there. They want to buy them in order to grow them on, start collecting their vegetables for planting out later. Tomatoes, fine. I'm not worried about them. Peppers, eggplants, you know, let's hold off a little bit on those, even if you're an early bird and want to transplant them, because if they get subjected to the kind of temperatures we're looking at, say, for this weekend, we don't know what the long-range forecast is yet, they would be set back by, you really wouldn't be gaining anything. So we're at that in-between stage, early enough for early birds to be thinking about collecting the varieties they're going to plant, shifting them up into the pot so they can grow them in, keeping them in a sheltered location where they put on nice, vigorous growth, starting to plan for their peppers and eggplant, that kind of thing is all absolutely fine. Most garden centers will start bringing in plants for you folks, sometime in March, depending on the weather. Again, for planting them out in the garden, we've got all these rules, temperature, soil temperature, whatever. For best results, we plant tomatoes in April, peppers and eggplants in May. April is a big month. If you're an early bird, plant in early April, okay? Not in March.
So one other reason that people might want to come in and get their tomato plants early is to get a particular variety that they want to try this year. So Don, when do you plan to have a bunch of varieties of of tomatoes coming in? When is your big rush of tomatoes coming? You always get a few little early ones, but yeah.
We have actually started the seed of the varieties we know we can't get from growers. And we're going to be, such as Rugby, some of the ones that we tout but can't get, Rugby, Bodacious, some of those other varieties, Blue Ribbon, things that have done very well for me that I don't have any bedding plant growers that are doing. They're already underway in those greenhouses. If they're just starting, they're on warm pads. If you're an avid seed grower, you should definitely invest in a warm pad, because then you don't even need a greenhouse for it. You just need a sheltered location. Some of them have moved from the warm pads where they were sprouting into their cell packs or the smaller pots, and they're already in the greenhouses. Some of them are actually saleable in a couple of weeks for people who want them. We're intending to move those up to quart pots, but they'll be available in smaller pots. Best selection of tomatoes in the Sacramento Valley is, or should be, in the month of April. That's when they really should be coming in. You should have access to almost anything you want. But there are many of you that are looking for heirloom varieties that just aren't going to be out there, or that unusual hybrid that you've been getting every year. You can order that seed right now. You can plant that seed here. We're in zone 9, USDA zone 9, sunset zone 14, in the first week of March. And that will be just about perfect for planting out from a 4-inch or quart pot in your garden in about the third week of April, which is almost always when we get to the temperature of the soil that we want, the night temperatures that we want. So if you're doing them from seed, first week of March, even into the second week of March is fine. And by the way, all the way into April is fine. You can still plant them out in May and get excellent results. I just don't want people thinking there's some outer limit to when you can plant. I do my last planting of tomatoes every year in the first week of July. Okay, that's really late. But we also have good tomato growing and harvest season all the way through October here. So I do that just for fun, just to try different varieties, see how they respond to it. And every year, the ones I do in first week of July give me a very good yield, obviously not as big as the ones that I planted in April or May, but I still get good results planting as late as July. So there's not some race against time. The race against time that I encounter in conversations with people, they think, quote, is going to be too hot for the tomatoes to do well.
You can't be too hot for tomatoes.
Tomatoes love heat. The issue is pollination. And we do get hot in July, and there's periods in July when they're not self-pollinating because of high temperatures. But really, every year I've lived here, which is a fair number now, in August, we cool down. Our weather changes. I'm not saying it's cool and balmy and pleasant the whole month of August. I'm not crazy. But there are periods of, let's say, at least half the days in which we get good pollination in late July and in through August and even into early September. So it's not like you really have this race. I have talked with people who have gardened in extreme climates, desert areas, parts of Texas, places like that. Yeah, there's a race against time for them, because every single summer day is at least 95 degrees. So I gather, plant as early as they can, try to get as many as they can on so they can be harvesting in July. Not sure what they do at that point. I've had different conversations with people. Hey, if you live in Texas, send me a note. How do you deal with your tomatoes when it's that hot? But here we have, thankfully, the Delta breeze that comes in roughly typical summer. 50% of the days in our growing season are suitable for self-pollination of tomatoes. 50%. In a rough year, we had a really hot summer a few years ago when I was tracking this. It was only 35% of the days that were suitable for
that. That's still a lot of days for tomatoes.
It was. The yield was down that year, but it was still enough days of suitable pollination for people to get that good late crop as well. So it's not a race against time here like it might be in, I don't know, Brownsville, Texas. Let's use that as a good example. Anybody living in those regions that has experience with extreme heat and tomatoes, send us a note. We'd love to learn about it.
You know, and that may be why they grow peppers instead of tomatoes.
Yeah, well, part of it, peppers in the Southwest enjoy that long, late season, late summer and fall. We had the good fortune to be down in Santa Fe and Taos, New Mexico, once in late October, early November, just as the whole hatch pepper crop was coming in, and every store was just piles and piles of hatch peppers. And you could tell from the weather, although it was getting quite chilly at night, they were going to continue ripening probably through the month of October and even into November if you move them into a sheltered location. So the fact that they tend not to get wet, rainy, and extremely cold early is part of the reason they do so well down there. Plus, of course, it's traditional. By the way, those are great peppers for this region. If you're a pepper aficionado, my favorite core pepper that I grow a couple dozen of every year are the hatch peppers from New Mexico.
Well, let's move on to peppers, but from the mailbag. Okay. Matt writes to us. Hi, Don and Lois. I have peppers starting in my indoor greenhouse that have become longer than I would like. I should have taken the seed tray lid off earlier and moved the grow lights closer. Lesson learned. Mm-hmm. My question is, can I plant the peppers deep like tomatoes when I move them into bigger pots? No surprise, the internet has conflicting information on the subject. Thank you in advance for clarifying. Go ahead, Don, clarify.
I do it quite regularly. I often wondered if they produce adventitious roots, which is the term we use for the new roots that form at the node where a leaf or a stem has emerged. And yes, they do. Not nearly as robustly as tomatoes do. We always tell you, you can drop your tomatoes in deep. And if you wrap a tomato stem with something like sphagnum moss, just for an experiment, it will form new roots all up and down the stem. You'll get, 30 new roots forming along the stem that would have otherwise been up above ground. In the case of peppers, I've explored, after having done this, in pots or in the ground, and you get a few roots at each node. So the risk of planting plants deeper is that they might rot because of moisture around the stem. That has never happened to me in all the years I've been dropping peppers in deeper. I mean, when we tell you don't plant a tree too deep or don't plant a shrub too deep, it's because soil and moisture trapped around the crown under high temperature conditions can lead to Phytophthora crown rot. I've literally never seen that with a pepper or an eggplant or a tomato. So yes, you can drop.
They're all in the same family, aren't they?
Yeah, these are all in the nightshade family, Solanaceae. And so it's very easy to test this yourself. And I do drop them in. I make sure that the node, at least one node, is buried. And I have found that it does root out of that. More to the point, because I've often, being a nursery guy that has things that would be thrown out, and we all like to take them home and make use of them, I have planted pepper plants that were 2 feet tall in 3-inch pots. Wow. should have been put in the dumpster, right? Instead of putting them in the dumpster, I take them home. And just like tomatoes, I drop them down deeper and they do just fine. So that's anecdotal. That's not based on peer-reviewed published studies, but I can tell you I've done it many, many times. But the key question was, do they form adventitious roots that will then help to stabilize the plant when you put it in deeper? And the answer is yes, they do.
Well, potatoes are in that same family. You can drop them real deep.
You should, actually, yeah.
In fact, you should keep burying the stem and you'll make more and more potatoes.
There are probably... So
would those be adventitious potatoes?
Yeah, those are adventitious roots, which form new tubers right there at their base, which is one of the reasons you'll find all these fascinating techniques for growing potatoes. I've had people who stack tires around them, fill them up with soil as the plant grows so that the tires absorb heat, which in some climates is a good thing. And then you're filling them with soil and they're filling them with soil until they're maybe 3 or 4 tires deep. And then when the season is over, you just pull the tire up and the little potatoes tumble down. Those have formed at the base of the adventitious roots that came out of the stem. So yes, potatoes are always planted deep that way. And it just gets you better yield in their case. But yes, they're all closely related. And I had often wondered if peppers do form adventitious roots. So I did some direct empirical research on the topic. And the answer is yes.
Well, yes. Here I am. I live in Davis. I don't have a farm. I don't ever take old tires off. So what am I going to do? I don't have the old tires for that. So what I did, and I thought this was really smart, is I went and got some of those big 5-gallon black pots that you all have lying around after you've gotten rid of the trees and stuff. So those were available. So I took some of those. I planted the potato in the bottom one with the soil about halfway up, so it was a good solid, had some room to grow. And then I kept putting more soil in as the thing grew taller. Then I cut the bottom off another one of these 5-gallon pans, slipped it down over the plant into it.
And
so I doubled the height. And as the tomato grew up, I just kept adding soil. And one year, I actually had 3 of those. It was a little bit it was tall and skinny.
Yes,
but two is a goodly amount. Yes. But anyway, it was fun, and boy, there were a lot of little tomatoes in there.
And once potatoes, I assume you meant not
potatoes.
Yeah, this is another case where the 15-gallon nursery bucket might be the most appropriate size, because you can fill it halfway up, plant your potatoes in the bottom. I didn't really mean to go into a whole potato discussion here, but why not? And then put a couple inches of soil, let them sprout, add a couple more inches of soil until it's all the way full up to the top. And you've got 1.5 cubic feet of soil in a 15-gallon container. For the record, that has become my standard minimum size for growing any kind of summer vegetable. And some of them, it's even still too small. But you can, if you want to grow a tomato plant, this can be a normal tomato in a container. 15-gallon bucket full of soil is 1.5 cubic feet of soil. That's kind of the bare minimum in our climate, just enabling you to keep it watered more than anything. But you could actually gradually fill it up. And then when the potato begins to flower, you back off on the watering carefully, more carefully than in the ground, because you can go from enough water to not enough water at all very quickly in a container. So you have to gradually back off on the watering. When the whole top has died down, push it over. There are all your potatoes. So if you're into growing potatoes, by the way, I keep getting the question, sometime in the month of March, we typically get our potatoes in.
So I don't know if y'all are familiar with this, but there is a tool, a device that is a square wooden frame covered with a wire mesh that is for sorting gravel.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just a, think of it as a giant strainer. Mm-hmm. And so if you have two of those buckets that you're talking about, and you're going to harvest your tomatoes, just put this thing over the other one and scoop out, you know, one scoopful at a time, put it on there. The soil will fall through, the tomatoes be on the top. It's a great way to make sure you get all those little tomatoes.
Just to clarify, every time she said tomato, she meant potato. Potato. You say tomato, you mean potato.
I'm going to
play Ella Fitzgerald coming up in the next program. All right, let's go on to the next question.
Okay, so we'll get rid of Matt's potato growing question.
And the pepper growing question. You're confusing all the members of the Nightshade family completely now.
All right. Now,
we assume our listeners have figured this out.
Oh, they know us. I'm sure they know us. I hope they're laughing along with us. All right. So we have an old listener who is a new writer. So Rebecca says, hi, Lois and Don. I noticed she said Lois and Don. Everybody else is Don and Lois.
Okay, you get to answer this question.
I do. I've been listening to your podcast almost, gosh, could it be 20 years? Well, it's almost 18 years. In any case, thank you so much for all the advice that I have gotten over the decades. Decades? Oh, my God. I live in the Sierras at about 3,500 feet.
Stay safe.
Oh, yeah. The blizzard conditions coming your way. We recently had to take out some trees following last year's big snows. Oops, more snows. I think my zone is 9-8 after the rezoning this year, or maybe it's 8-B. One of the stumps is about 4 to 5 feet tall and sits in a turnaround in my driveway. And instead of doing a big stump removal process, I'm considering turning it into a feature. Mm-hmm. The concept is to hollow out the middle of the stump at the top and then plant some kind of trailing vines or something in there, and maybe with space to put some annuals in every year, treating it like a natural planter box, essentially. I can set up a watering system if I have to. There's a functional but disused sprinkler system in that section of the property. Around the foot of the stump is what I think is St. John's wort. It's a very spreading plant with wide green leaves and yellow flowers that bloom once. I want to get rid of it eventually, but it's not an immediate priority.
Yeah, we'll come back to that. Yes.
Can you please advise me if the concept of this is possible? Yes, it is. And if so, please recommend water-wise plants that will trail and vine downward and also provide good habitat for critters, pollinators, and so forth without being stupidly invasive, unless it can crop out the St. John's wort. Okay. Flowering is not a need, but it would be nice to have. Oh, yes. I did find a stump planter idea on Pinterest, and she attaches two photos from different areas. Yeah. Here are two example photos. I'm not hoping to replicate the look exactly because it's clearly a different climate in the photos, but instead to take inspiration from them. And what she shows is a stump. It looks to be about 2 feet tall, 2.5 feet tall. And it's got lots of geraniums and that sort of thing. And then the other one is another stump, I guess about 2.5-3 feet tall. And it's got a whole bunch of annuals in it. It's got petunias. And is that potato vine?
Well, let's back up here. Let's first talk about the St. John's wort, which is Hypericum, Hypericum calycinum. It's a ground cover. The genus Hypericum are all recognizable with a distinct sort of butter or golden yellow flower, and they're very pretty. And the shrub forms are great choices here in the valley and even up in, at fairly high elevations, because they give one big seasonal bloom. Here it's about the month of May. I'm very accustomed to people walking in with the flower. There's a parking lot at a, in North Davis where it's the main shrub, and suddenly people notice them. They want to know if we can get them. Great choice. The ground cover, St. John's wort, and this is not the medicinal St. John's wort, but it's the same genus, different species, is a real spreader. And I really don't recommend people plant it. It can be very hard to get rid of. And honestly, the simplest way to get rid of it is, I hate, well, simple being a relative term, is to just dig it out. It's not something that you're going to get rid of by using chemicals. It's not something that you're going to crowd out. It's a very aggressive ground cover. And so if it's in a place where it's okay with you, the way to manage it is to just mow it down every year or two, just as hard as you can with a brush mower, and let it start over. Do it right after the bloom if you want to enjoy the flowers. That's how most people manage that plant, because it is difficult to get rid of. I have had people get rid of it by simply smothering it with landscape fabric or something like that for a good portion of the season. That will kill it out. Just be sure to monitor and follow up if it starts to come back. So that's a tough one. It's pretty, it's got its place, but I don't recommend it really at all for this reason. However, your pictures are great. And Pinterest, by the way, can be an excellent resource for this kind of thing, except that you need to know from a local expert whether these are things that will grow in your area, whether they're perennial, whether they're annual. And the first one, the first stump that she shows, so I'll probably post this with the show description on kdrt.org, is that beautiful chartreuse leafed sweet potato that people have been using like crazy for filler. And it is definitely annual. It's not going to survive as an outdoor plant outside of zone 10. I'm not sure it even does there. But we plant it as we get into the warm season, and it looks like a vine. It trails. It has these heart-shaped leaves that are a lovely yellowish green color. There are variegated forms that are dark green with mottling. It is a true sweet potato, which means it's in the morning glory family. I know that confuses people. And the flower is actually kind of pretty, but it's mainly grown for this lush, attractive, tropical-looking foliage. It's one of my favorite filler plants. So that gets
And there's also a purple one, isn't there?
Yes, and there's one that's got this real cool white and pink variegation. When people are doing planters, if you ever decide to go to a garden center and take one of their how to do a planter seminars, you're going to hear about thrillers, fillers, and spillers. Every planter, and this is a simple formula, every planter should have one of each of those, at least. In this particular one, they forgot the thriller, but they've got the fillers and the spillers. And what you're mainly asking about in your question here is spillers and fillers. Okay, so a thriller is a spiky accent plant, a grass, and that's a great thing to add if it's not too overwhelming. Some kind of a grass or a sedge or an iris-like plant, basically a pointed or blade-like leaf. Great if it has some color contrast. It's the backdrop to all these other things. The fillers are the kind of fluffy plants that you put in around it that will look full. And in this particular, very common for that is just geraniums. I mean, that's one of the most common filler type plants because they bloom and they're nice. Here in the valley floor, we're using Mexican heather, which is Cufia. It's not a heather, but it kind of looks like one. If you're in the coastal areas, heather would be great. Heather doesn't like hot, dry climates. Up where you are, some of the heathers might be appropriate. Mexican heather is a great filler. Here in zone 9A, 9B, it can freeze back, but it always recovers. Anything colder than that, you should treat it as an annual. But it comes in bloom, and it never stops blooming. I mean, it just has these cute little flowers all summer long. So Mexican heather is a very good filler. But of course, geraniums are. I mean, they're so common that I feel kind of like, why would we even mention them? Except there's a reason they're so common. They give a lot of bloom. They're easy to care for. The second picture has a lot of garden geraniums in it that look like they were just planted. Here in the valley, once we hit middle of May, geraniums and petunias start getting attacked by the geranium budworm, which is a caterpillar that eats, well, the name is appropriate. They lay their eggs on the buds of the geranium or the petunia and certain other flowers. And as they hatch out, they start feeding immediately on the flowers. So the first thing you notice is, hey, my plant isn't blooming anymore. And they're kind of a hassle for us to manage, to the point that I'm not really a big fan of selling geraniums or petunias all that much, because it turns into one of those things you just have to spray for all summer long. Yes, there's an organic spray, but you got to spray like every week. So here, they can be a bit of a nuisance, but I am told by people who live in different climates, they tend to be a very late season problem there, not all summer long like they are here. So garden geraniums, common garden geraniums, if you like the fancy flowered pelargoniums, which your grandmother called Martha Washington geraniums, those are cool, shorter bloom season, but really dramatic flowers. But the classic one for containers are the ivy geraniums, which cascade. They have a shiny leaf. And for those of you listening here, geranium budworm does not infest ivy geraniums. However, ivy geraniums also don't like blinding hot sun. Common garden geraniums are fine with blinding hot sun. So if you're in the full sun, probably don't do the ivy geraniums. But if you're up at a higher elevation where you're not going to be 105 degrees in the summer, you could probably do very well with ivy geraniums. And they could function either as a filler, in the case of these new hybrids where they've actually crossed common garden geraniums and ivy geraniums, you could use them as a filler, or the regular old-fashioned ivy geraniums, that's your spiller. And you've got lots of plants that can be spillers. Lobelia is a good example. You can stick in a few little ivy plants as long as you don't let them get away from you. You can put in periwinkle. I mean, there's lots of things you could plant as long as you make sure, if it's a vigorous spreader like ivy or periwinkle, that you don't let it get away from you. For us in the valley, we are preferring to lean people towards succulents. Your elevation, you should probably look at the hardiness of them, but succulents can fit all three categories. We have succulents that are thrillers, succulents that are fillers, and succulents that are spillers. And then, of course, you wouldn't have to water as often.
You were talking about things there, some of which were perennial, some of which were annual. Mm-hmm. It's a little confusing. So I want to ask you about the, well, no, I want to answer this question. You said I could.
Yes.
So you said, she said, one of the stumps is still about 4 to 5 feet tall,
yeah,
and fits in a turnaround in my driveway. So from that description, I'm going to assume that it is going to be viewed from all angles, from all sides. It doesn't have a back and a front. It's just got edges. Okay.
That's right. There you go. It's round. Yeah. It's very important, actually.
There's nothing that says how wide this tree was.
Right.
So if the tree is 12 inches across, that's very little room to grow anything. If it's 5 feet across, then you got a nice big place to go. So my suggestion to you is shorten that stump a little bit. In other words, if it's 4 to 5 feet tall, very few people are going to be able to see into it, especially if you're driving in a car. So you might want to find someone with a nice saw to cut it off absolutely level, because most tree stumps are not level. Mm-hmm. Cut it off absolutely, maybe at then 3 feet or something like that. And then in addition to considering what you can plant in a scooped out portion of it, which of course is going to be a challenge because the stump is going to rot underneath there and use up a bunch of nitrogen. You're going to need to water and feed. But here's a thought. If you put some draping spilling plants around it on there, but above it, you have a nice wooden stand holding a bird bath, you could have a really spectacular centerpiece there. Mm. And if you live up in the hills there, I'm sure that there are people around who are great crafts workers in wood, so or metal.
Adding a bird bath to your stump planter is a great idea. Now, I've got a question for you about that. Every now and then I'll see a bird bath like out in the middle of a lawn, and I think that doesn't comport with what I know about birds and their uses. Now, sure, jays and mockingbirds would probably jump right in there. If it's not got shrubbery nearby or anything for them to harbor in, are littler birds likely to use a bird bath?
The smaller the bird, the more it prefers to be near a bush.
Okay.
That's true.
So she'll get ostriches, hawks, eagles.
That's not what I said.
Pigeons.
she'll definitely get jays. Yeah. And up there at that altitude, I don't know what else she's got out there. She might have robins, she might have juncos, she might have I don't know what she's got as far as birds in that area.
3,500 feet, yeah.
Yeah. And depending on the yard, if she's got a bunch of trees around, now I know she cut down at least one.
Right.
But if there are more trees around and it's slightly shaded, then she'll get more birds.
Yeah.
But anyway, in any case, you can have a bird bath.
That's a great idea. And if you have a water feature like that and some twiggy stuff nearby it, you'll get dragonflies. You'll get all kinds of interesting things going on. There's lots of trailing plants. And you asked the question about annual versus perennial. There are plants that would be perennial for us on the valley floor and function as annuals up there. This gets into that definitional issue within our industry. What is an annual? Well, I mean, if you're in Chicago, a geranium is an annual, presumably. Here, there are many of the plants we've talked about. I've had people tell me that sweet potato, for example, does come back for them. I don't promise that, but it sometimes does. I don't think that's gonna happen when you're at 3,500 feet. So you buy a new one each year. And there wouldn't be that much going on in this planter in the wintertime unless you choose your plants pretty carefully. I would think that the thriller, the stiffer, more upright plant should probably be something that you know is reliably hardy up at your elevation. And the filler, that would be great if it is. And the cascading plant is something you would probably tuck in again seasonally. But there's some pretty classic plants in our industry for each of those categories. We love to do these things with succulents because they do very, very well in our hot climate and we don't have to water them that often. But one thing I'm happy to see is people not siloing these plants as much as they used to, you know, where they'll buy hen and chicks and geraniums and lobelia and whatever, and put them all together using succulents as part of a mix with other things. So unfortunately, well, we all do it. Nurseries and garden centers tend to separate these things out. Your bedding plants are over there and your perennials are over there and your succulent cactus are over there. Try pulling some things together. Be sure to ask locally if it's going to take the full sun in your climate, because some of the things we've talked about, like lobelia, is not great in full hot sun here in the summer, but does well in cooler climates. Ivy geraniums may well be fine for you in full sun. Definitely not something I like to see people do here. And group them and try different things. And if you see more pictures on Pinterest, as I say, people do this all the time. They'll bring in a picture, point it at me and say, does this grow here? Your local garden center should be able to answer that question. But keep that in mind. One big plant, one sort of dramatic plant, the fillers around them that hopefully are something that's more or less perennial, or that at least you can won't have to replace every season, you know, maybe short-lived perennials, but lots of things for that. And then, of course, the cascading ones are what give the whole thing its very elegant appearance. And there's lots of choices in that category as well. One that's become very popular here is the silver-leafed dichondra. Silver Falls dichondra is the variety. Looks just like the dichondra lawn that you have, except that it's got a white bloom on the leaf, and it's a very attractive plant. Gray foliage is really useful in this kind of situation. One of the most popular uses for hen and chicks, the echeverias, is that they can take full sun up where you are. A little more shade is better for them here, but they also give a great foliar contrast and that sort of dramatic texture that they have. This is part of why succulents have become so popular. And we even have, for those of you that prefer this, some native succulents, California natives like Dudleas, that can work for you. And there are some very hardy succulents. Some of the sedums or stone crops, some of the delospermas are hardy enough to grow even in Denver. So I guess they're going to do well at 3,500 foot elevation in California. So if you like the idea of succulents, which you could probably go a week or more between waterings up there, that might be a good way, good direction. But you don't have to just stick to them. Kufia, the Mexican heather, with hen and chicks and a cascading dichondra would be a very dramatic combination.
I personally like Kenilworth ivy, which is, I don't think, an ivy.
No.
What is it and would it grow up there? It's a lovely, lovely plant. It's very delicate. It trails.
Well, this is kind of funny. Highly invasive in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. Grows nicely here, but freezes back every so often. Certainly going to freeze up there. So this is one of those plants, wherever you're listening, find out whether it's appropriate to your region. If you're in Berkeley, you don't want Kenilworth ivy. It'll be all over your yard. If you're in Davis, oh, it's a fun plant for a year or two. That's the end of it. Up there, it's definitely an annual. So it's one of that category. This is a plant that people listening in mild coastal climates would go, oh my God, never plant that thing. Fortunately for us, every so often we get just cold enough to clean it out for us.
Okay, so we have had a couple of questions from people about whether or not you are going to get seeds, weed seeds, in your compost if you get compost. And I think that the concern is with the local compost, because here in Davis, we have a city-run, county-run procedure where they come by and they pick up our compostables from every house, and they put them in, and then they make compost out of them. And so, Don, what is it? Is it safe? Will you get weed seeds in there?
Well, way back when they first started making city compost and then giving it away to customers, I had one customer, and this is a long time ago, who from one batch of this, quote, compost, end quote, ended up with Bermuda grass, nutsedge, and dodder. of the three, the daughter was the most fascinating because that's a parasite plant. It was also a little hard to explain to the customer. It's a morning glory family member that grows as a parasite on other plants.
But, it's just shocking yellow orange color.
Yeah, it looks like somebody, when you're driving around the countryside, especially on alfalfa, you'll see what looks like someone lost a whole bunch of fishing line, you know, a big tumble of it in one spot. That's daughter. It's a vine. I think it's fascinating. I think it's interesting. And there's even native species. And but it's not something you really want in your backyard. And you certainly don't want Bermuda grass or nut sedge. If the compost pile has been managed correctly, such as 131 degrees, according to the city website, then you should not have weed seeds. You indeed should not even have little pieces of stem, such as what you got from your nut sedge or your Bermuda grass, which are not coming up from seed. Properly managed compost will not have pathogens, will not have weed seeds. For anyone to call it compost in the state of California, including municipalities, it has to have been kept at that temperature for a fixed period of time, and they have to certify that to the state. Okay, so this is one of the reason I wanted to bring this up. You're not seeing very many bagged products in garden centers in California that have the word compost on them anymore. Because in order to put compost as the label, we used to sell a product called planting compost. The manufacturer had it in piles out in the sun. They took front end loaders. They kept moving it, you know, piling it up, turning it just like you do on a smaller scale. But if they wanted to sell that as with compost as part of its label, they had to validate for each batch to the state that had reached this internal temperature and been kept there for a certain period of time. The composting process in Yolo County generally reaches temperatures, they tell us, of 140 to 190 degrees throughout the aerobic composting phase, which lasts at least 2 weeks. And this is in addition to the anaerobic phase, and I won't bother explaining the difference, that is about 120 degrees for about 20 weeks. So it's been piled up for many weeks. It has reached a verified, validated internal temperature high enough to prevent the spread of pathogens or weed seeds or even weed fragments. That's the good news. And they
so the answer is you're safe to use the county's compost.
Yes.
That's how do you get it?
They announce it. Usually good news for us here over on Fifth Street is they just come bring it over and dump it at the garden there because that's where the community gardens are. It's gone right away. Next door is one of the places where next door is actually a pretty valuable resource because it tends to get noted on there. Local Facebook groups may also apprise you of it. In a community like Davis, demand far exceeds supply. So you're going to have to rush over there and get your own at some point. But if you want information, and there's a great website for this, it is yolocounty.org. You could probably just type in Yolo County compost and you'll find the FAQs there, how they make it, what's made from, how long they do it, and all that kind of stuff that we just talked about. So just head on over to yolocounty.org, the government website, and look for the information about their composting process. You have been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.